Fall registration for Henry Ford Community College is underway, with a wide variety of programs and degree options to choose from. Let HFCC guide you on your way to higher education. For more information, contact the Office of Registration and Records by calling 313-845-6403 or online at hfcc.edu.
8. I deliver your Sunday paper every week.
7. I'm the intern. We work on the same floor.
1 in 8 Americans is struggling with hunger.
6. Our kids walk to school together every day.
Including millions of children and seniors.
5. We chat in the elevator at work sometimes.
We all know people who aren't sure where their next meal is coming from.
4. I'm your cashier at the grocery store.
3. I work at the coffee shop around the corner.
2. I'm your babysitter. I care for your children.
1. I'm your grandmother's friend. We play bingo together.
Who's the 1 in 8 in your life that needs help? You can make a difference through Feeding America and its nationwide network of more than 200 food banks. Take action at feedingamerica.org/1in8. A public service announcement brought to you by Feeding America and the Ad Council.
WHFR will once again be broadcasting live during the city's annual Dearborn Homecoming, August 3rd through 5th at Ford Field Park, located north of Michigan Avenue between Mason and Howard. Along with our live broadcast, we will also be holding our dollar CD sales, so don't forget to stop by and check us out. That's August 3rd through 5th at this year's Dearborn Homecoming.
Criminal justice studies are concerned with the preservation of peace, the prevention of crime, and the protection of life and property. A knowledge of the role of criminal justice in our society also serves to emphasize the importance of balancing the needs of society to maintain social order against the need to safeguard individual rights. For more information on the HFCC Associate Degree Program in Criminal Justice, contact the Criminal Justice Department at one of the following numbers: 313-845-6437, 313-845-9714, or 313-845-9859.
Do you like rock and roll? Do you love rock and roll? Or do you absolutely love rock and roll?
So do I. My name's Steve Avine. I'm your DJ here every Tuesday from 10 to midnight at the Rock Spectrum Radio Show here at WHFR.FM, the station making waves. Here on the Rock Spectrum, you'll hear all the best rock
and metal
around. So come on, come join me every Tuesday from 10 to midnight. I guarantee you won't regret it.
This is WHFR, Dearborn.
Disclaimer: this show is a WHFR talk show presentation. The opinions expressed by WHFR staff and our guests are not necessarily those of anyone here at Henry Ford Community College, not faculty, staff, administrators, anyone on our board of trustees, or students.
Earth Sky.
Welcome to Earth Sky 22, 22 minutes of science interviews and great music from Austin, Texas. I'm Jorge Salazar. Here's a scientist soundbite.
There are two major meteor showers that go on in late July and, you know, from early to mid-August. And those two are the Delta Aquaridge showers. And then combined with that, starting in the early part of August and going into mid-August, you have the Perseid meteors.
That's Skywatcher Deborah Bird. More with her later, but first, Science News of the Week with Michael Brennan and Emily Howard.
NASA announced on July 18th that the Cassini spacecraft orbiting Saturn has captured images at visible wavelengths of lightning on the day side of Saturn. This is a first. We had images of lightning on the night side of the planet, but daytime lightning at visible wavelengths, which would need to be very intense according to these scientists, had never been seen. The lightning was part of a vast storm on Saturn that raged throughout 2011.
Most worlds orbiting distant suns are larger than Earth. It makes sense we'd see the biggest ones first. But on July 18th, astronomers using NASA's Spitzer Space Telescope and at the University of Central Florida announced the possible detection of an exoplanet only two-thirds the size of Earth, orbiting the red dwarf star GJ-436, just 33 light-years away. If they're right, this might be the nearest world to our solar system that is smaller than our home planet.
An ice island twice the size of Manhattan is breaking off the Petermann Glacier in Greenland this week. This is the second time in 2 years that this glacier has been seen to lose a massive chunk of ice. Scientists first reported this year's calving on July 16th. NASA's Aqua satellite captured the view from space, which you can see at earthsky.org. Search for the word glacier.
The National Oceanic and Atmospheric Administration, or NOAA, and the National Climatic Data Center, NCDC, have now released the Global Climate Report for June 2012. In this report, NOAA states that June 2012 was the fourth warmest June since record-keeping began in 1880. At the same time, the land and ocean average surface temperature for June 2012 for the Northern Hemisphere showed June 2012 as the all-time warmest Northern Hemisphere June on record.
On June 25th, the U.S. Geological Survey reported that federal scientists observed three species of endangered Hawaiian forest birds in new areas of the Hakalauan Forest National Wildlife Refuge. It was the first time in 30 years that the birds were observed in lower portions of the Hawaiian Island forest, and the new findings are giving hope to recovery efforts. That's Science News of the Week. I'm Emily Howard.
I'm Michael Brennan. This week's Song of the Week is by Slow Train. It's called Not the Only One, from their album, Bound to Find You Out.
If there's one thing I can say, is that no matter what I say, nobody's listening anyway. Nobody's listening anyway. But I'd like to get you to, so I pen these words for you, like you said you like me too, because you said you like me too. But it's not the only one, he's only just begun. He's only just begun. It's not the only one. He got the best of me. He asked me, can you see? That I could not see. He got the best of me, but I like to have some too. So I purchased this for you, like you said you like me too, because you said you like me too. But it's not the only one. He's only just begun. He's only just begun. Did the best that I could do. I do no wrong to you. It's true. You know I knew you all along. It's true. It's true. You know I knew you all along. It's true. It's true. And I saw through you all along. But it's not the only one. He's only just begun. Thank you.
We're Earth Sky, broadcast on over 1,200 stations worldwide, including Voice of America. Deborah Bird is here with some great news about the global night sky. Get ready for meteors. Welcome, Deborah.
Hey, Jorge. Oh, it's that time of year again, the time to start thinking about observing meteor showers. And we've had so many questions about this in the past few weeks. So every summer, and I'm talking about Northern Hemisphere summer now, we get these questions from people about when can I see the meteors? Because people know that summer is a great time for watching meteors.
And this is, by summer, we mean July, right?
Well, July and August. So what happens is that there are two major meteor showers that go on in late July and, you know, from early to mid-August. And those two are the Delta Aquaridge showers, which really don't have a very definite peak. But some say they peak in late July. I've really seen them all the way into, say, the middle of August. So they sort of ramble along for a couple of weeks there, the Delta Aquaridge meteor shower. And then combined with that, starting in the early part of August and going into mid-August, you have the Perseid meteors.
Awesome. So is this just for the Northern Hemisphere or the Southern Hemisphere too?
Well, both hemispheres can see this, but what's great about the meteor showers for the northern part of Earth is that it's the season of summer now, so it's warm. For the southern hemisphere, really the Geminid shower in December is probably a more popular shower because it's in their summer. But for us, the Perseid shower is the one that most people know and love, the August Perseid shower. It's a very reliable shower, tends to produce about 60 meteors an hour. That's about one a minute, and they come in little clumps and bursts. So if you take a lawn chair and lie outside in a dark place, you'll see the meteors.
Yeah, I was going to ask. I've got my list out here. I'm ready to write down everything I need in order to see the meteor. So tell us, what do we need in order to see these?
Well, the number one thing you need is a dark sky. So you want to go someplace where, you know, if you can get to a place where you can see the Milky Way, that's ideal. The darker, the better. People do sometimes tell us that they see meteors from within the city. And my kids have told me they've seen them off our back deck. So that's super cool. And if you can do that, that's great. But if you really want to have the experience of a number of meteors falling throughout the night, you're going to want to go to a dark location. So all you really need after that is just something to lie down on. And I like to take one of those, you know, lawn chairs that you can, those folding lawn chairs that you can just open up and lie down and, you know, look up and watch the sky. There's no particular direction that you have to look in, and that's a misconception that's grown up in the past few decades, that there's some place in the sky that you have to kind of keep your eyes riveted on in order to see the meteors. That's not the case. The meteors do radiate from a particular point in the sky, but they'll appear all over the sky.
So, Deborah, are we going to have dark skies for this meteor shower?
Well, the moon is always a factor. So here in 2012, as you're hearing this, the moon is, you're hearing this probably around mid to late July, and the moon is in a waxing phase at this point. So the moon is getting larger in the evening sky. Now, the best time to watch for meteors is after midnight, and that's very important. Look for meteors after midnight. The reason you'll see more then is that the part of Earth you're standing on has turned you in the direction of Earth's motion and orbit. So the meteors are coming into the atmosphere over your head, and you're just going to see more meteors at that time. So after midnight. So when will the sky be moon-free after midnight? And the answer to that is that it'll be moon-free after midnight, you know, for a lot of July, most of July, in fact. The first quarter moon comes on July 26. First quarter moon sets around midnight. So all the way up until, say, you know, the end of July, say starting now until the end of July, if you go outside after midnight, you're likely to see some meteors, especially as we get closer to the end of July. But then the moon is going to start becoming a factor in that sky after midnight. And full moon, in fact, comes on August 2nd. So, you know, the full moon, or we, you know, people do see meteors in the light of the full moon, you know, not ruling it out. But, you know, then all eyes are going to turn on the calendar toward the peak of the Perseid meteor shower, which comes from late at night on August 11th to early in the morning on August 12th. So where will the moon be then? There will be a moon in the sky, in the morning sky then, in the sky after midnight, there will be a moon in the sky for the peak of the Perseid meteor shower this year. But the closer you get to that August 12th date, the less of a moon you'll see. So if I had to, you know, give you some advice, Jorge, on what exact date you should watch the Perseid meteor shower this year, it's a very specific date. It's late at night from August 11th to early in the morning on August 12th. There will be a little crescent moon in the sky then, but not as much of a crescent moon as you would have seen the day before or the day before that. So early in the morning, August 12th, best time to see the Perseid meteors in 2012.
Great tips for watching meteors. Thanks, Deborah.
Thank you, Jorge.
Earth Sky's Deborah Bird, and we're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. Earth Sky, broadcast on over 1,200 stations worldwide, including Voice of America. Ryan Britton is back with another weird science story. Welcome, Ryan.
Thanks, Jorge. Today, I have a story about a probable scientific explanation for a very strange and weird occurrence that happened during the United States Civil War. So this is 140 years ago, and it was reported that wounds of some of the soldiers glowed in a pale blue light. So many people saw it, but didn't know what it was.
Wow, so this is light that came from the gunshot or the sword wound of soldiers in battle.
Right, the phenomenon was called angel's glow because the wounds that glowed tended to heal faster and cleaner than the wounds that didn't. Some thought that angels were healing them.
So this is kind of weird. Is it true? How do we know what's going on?
Well, there's a strong theory. A bioluminescent bacteria, it lives in the stomachs of nematodes. Now, nematodes are a species of worm. They're these teeny tiny little worms that live in parts of the United States South. This bacterium does glow a pale blue, as reported, and it also generates its own antibiotics. Now, it generates its own antibiotics because normally it lives in these little worms, these little nematode stomachs. These worms burrow into insect larvae as part of their normal life. And then they vomit up this glowing bacterium. So the bacterium not only kills the larvae, but it also kills other bacteria within the larvae. So that leaves the worm and the glowing bacteria to eat and grow undisturbed.
Yeah, so let me get this straight. So the soldier's wounds possibly had worms.
It's gross to think about. But it's theorized that the bacterium liked the wounds, and there they killed other bacterium that were present. The wounds were actually cleaner in a way.
That is really gross. Mm-hmm. But where can people find out more?
Well, you can go to mentalfloss.com. There's a good article there.
Thanks, Ryan.
Thank you.
Earth Sky's Ryan Britton. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. We'd love to hear from you on Facebook. Tell us where you're from. You can find us as Earth Sky. New evidence shows that billions of rocky planets might orbit the habitable zones around red dwarf stars in our own Milky Way galaxy. That's according to the European Southern Observatory. They made the first direct measurement of the frequency of planets around red dwarfs, which account for 80% of the stars in our galaxy. Here to talk more about these new observations is astronomer Stefan Udry at the University of Geneva in Switzerland. He's part of the European Southern Observatory HARP Science Team, short for High Accuracy Radial Velocity Planet Searcher. Dr. Udry, welcome.
Thank you very much.
What are the main results of your study on planets that orbit red dwarf stars?
Yes, we have a dedicated program searching for exoplanets around these low-mass stars. And we do that with a spectrograph that we have built or that has been built by a consortium led by our institute. And this instrument is the most precise one to measure the velocity of stars. And we detect the planet by seeing a change in the velocity of the star due to the presence of the planet.
Yeah. Tell us more about this. Media reports say that there are likely billions of planets that orbit these red dwarf stars. Tell us more about that.
Okay, the red dwarfs are interesting stars for several reasons. First, they are less massive than the Sun, so it's easier to detect the planet with our technique. That's the first point. The second point is that they are fainter than the Sun. So what we call the habitable zone, the zone with the good temperature for liquid water to exist around the star, is closer to the star than in the case of the Sun. And for us, with our technique of detection, we are more sensitive to planets that are close to their stars. So it's easier to detect habitable planets around low-mass stars, these red dwarfs, than around stars like the Sun. And on top of that, those stars are by far the most numerous one in the galaxy. So we have a sample of such stars, we look for planets, and we are finding that around 10% of them, roughly, they are rocky planets. And as there are 100 billions of those stars in the galaxy, we conclude that there are tens of billions of planets that are rocky around those stars in our galaxy. So it's we are on our way to detect places like the Earth where life could be developing. So all our work is on a road that at the end will lead us to the detection of life somewhere else in the universe.
You've been listening to astronomer Stefan Udry. We're Earth Sky, a clear voice for science. And that's our show. Thank you for joining us. This week's show was recorded at Earth Sky Studio B in Austin, Texas, the live music capital of the world. Our producer is Michael Brennan. Executive producers are Peter Zandan, Ryan Britton, and Deborah Bird. Special thanks this week to our musical contributors.
For more information on the science and the music you heard this week, visit our website at earthsky.org. EarthSky is a clear voice for science.
There are too many artists, too much art, and not enough genius, I believe. Science is the art of the next age. There are so many artists, too much art, and not enough reason, I'm afraid. Silence is the song of the next age. But what we don't know won't hurt us. What we don't know won't keep us up.
Earth, sky.
We have a pretty rich and robust toolbox in chemistry. It's very opportunistic in many ways at this time in the development of the field to apply those tools to address problems of importance to society.
You're listening to materials scientist Joseph DeSimone, and this is Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science. Dr. DeSimone is a chemist and inventor. He holds over 115 patents, ranging from an eco-friendly way to make high-tech polymers, such as Teflon and Gore-Tex, to a bio-friendly heart stent, to using the manufacturing tools of the computer industry to make new vaccines and therapeutics. He spoke more about the process of science and about what it's like to discover things and make things with Earth Sky's Jorge Salazar.
Dr. DeSimone, welcome to Earth Sky's Clear Voices for Science.
Thank you. Glad to be here.
Now, your research spans a broad range of science, medicine, technology, chemistry, material science. How would you describe what you do?
We lie at the interface of a lot of different things, and I think at one level we're problem solvers, another level we're entrepreneurs. And at the end of the day, we're material scientists. We like to apply the capabilities of polymer science and new polymer chemistries to tackle problems that range mostly today in life sciences, but as well in some areas of colloids and material sciences.
I'd like to talk a little bit about one of your first breakthroughs, and that's in creating an environmentally friendly way to make high-performance plastics. These polymers you were talking about earlier. In this case, the plastic is Teflon. Tell us about what guided your research to be able to make this breakthrough.
When I was an undergraduate at Ursinus College in Pennsylvania, I fell in love with polymer chemistry, and we had some terrific teachers at Ursinus, and I really became enamored with polymers, and I decided to go to graduate school and major in polymer science and polymer chemistry at Virginia Tech. And when I was there, my PhD advisor, Jim McGrath, a terrific, terrific researcher and scientist and professor, he exposed me not only to polymer synthesis, that is how to make macromolecules, but we also got exposed to an emerging area at the time called supercritical fluid extraction. And this is basically compressed carbon dioxide. And it was being used in the food industry for extracting caffeine from coffee beans, and so-called naturally decaffeinated coffee with nature's effervescence. And so we started fractionating polymers using supercritical fluids. And I thought, as I moved into my academic career, that wouldn't it be interesting to combine polymer synthesis with this supercritical fluid extraction process? And that became the foundation for how I launched my career. And, you know, I'm a firm believer that, as the business people will say, strategy is all about being different. And some of the most fertile ground for innovation lies between fields. So it really drove from that interface and then recognizing, you know, just why CO2 is useful in food processing, because it is natural, that it would be a green manufacturing process if, in fact, we could make polymers in CO2. And through a partnership with DuPont, we began making Teflon in CO2, and we pioneered that. And it was valuable and perceived to be valuable at that time, especially because DuPont was being hammered because of the environmentally unfriendly way that Teflon was being made at the time. And that this new method of using CO2 became a much more environmentally preferable way to make Teflon. And so that really launched us into a good run of about 15 years or so working in CO2 and doing a lot of different polymer chemistry in it.
Will you speak to the process of making things, something that you're very good at, from what I understand? Two examples, the bioabsorbable stents, and also something that you're working on nowadays as well, these incredibly small and precise templates to deliver new medicines inside the body. Talk a little bit about this process of how making things can lead to innovation. What are your thoughts?
Yeah, so the stent one was a terrific example and a terrific opportunity and experience. I met a man named Richard Stack, who is an interventional cardiologist at Duke University. He had shared with me this idea of having a bioabsorbable stent. He needed the polymer support and technology to help pull this off, and the challenge is daunting. I mean, most stents are metal, but you look back and you realize that before there were stents, it was just angioplasty, just opening up a blood vessel. And most people did okay with that, but sometimes those blood vessels would collapse and they needed to be propped open. And so a stent made a lot of sense. But why have a permanent prosthetic to a temporary healing issue? And that was the premise, and that was Richard's idea. And so we worked closely with him and developed a polymer-based stent that had the requisite mechanical properties to be balloon deployed and act like a metal stent, and then would provide mechanical support, but eventually would dissolve or degrade just like a bioabsorbable suture would. And then after a couple years, it's gone. So it's pretty exciting to see it go from basic concepts in less than a decade into many, many people. And now what we're doing is bridging two other areas. So actually back in my PhD work at Virginia Tech, I got exposed to a technology called lithography. And lithography is a basis by which polymers are used to make patterns on silicon wafers to make circuits, transistors. And it's the backbone of the semiconductor industry. And what we're doing now is that we're harnessing the manufacturing techniques of the computer industry and applying those techniques to make new vaccines and medicine. And so we're basically making particles, delivery vehicles, that are extremely uniform, that have all the precision and uniformity of transistors, and applying that to making particles. And so now we have a platform we call PRINT, Particle Replication and Non-Wetting Templates. It's a particle molding technology, and to make particles of controlled size and shape. And then we bring our chemical acumen and capabilities to design new chemistry such that we can make particles that are highly functional to do things that we want them to do. Deliver nucleic acids, deliver chemotherapy agents, seek out certain types of cells versus other cells. And so we're using these details of size, shape, chemistry, and elasticity to enhance the performance of vaccines and medicines.
You've been listening to Joseph DeSimone, the Chancellor's Eminent Professor of Chemistry at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and the William R. Keenan Jr., Distinguished Professor of Chemical Engineering at North Carolina State University. This Earth Sky podcast is part of the Thanks to Chemistry series produced in cooperation with the Chemical Heritage Foundation. Generous sponsorship support was provided by the BASF Corporation. Additional production support was provided by the Camille and Henry Dreyfus Foundation, DuPont, and ExxonMobil. Earth Sky is a clear voice for science.
We're at earthsky.org.
So hoist up the solar sail and trim the inertial vectors. We're off to ride a cosmic tide into uncharted sectors. And charge up the ion drive and chart the navigation. We'll be mates in altered states in cryo-hibernation.
From the Aquarium of the Pacific in Long Beach, California, this is Planetary Radio Live. Here is your host, the Planetary Society's Matt Kaplan.
Ahoy, me hearties. Welcome to Public Radio's travel show that takes you to the final frontier. We're at one of my favorite places in the world, the wonderful Aquarium of the Pacific. I've been a volunteer here since the groundbreaking for its beautiful seaside building. It was back in 1995. Could there be a better place to talk about oceans? I don't think so. Not just our home world's salty seas, but the vast oceans that appear to be hiding under thick ice on worlds like Jupiter's moon Europa. We'll hear from the aquarium's Director of Education, David Bader, and the Jet Propulsion Laboratory's Deputy Chief Scientist for Solar System Exploration, Kevin Hand. Planetary Society CEO Bill Nye, the science guy, will join the conversation. That's Michael Nieto over there providing our musical accompaniment. He'll have more nautical numbers for us in a few minutes. We'll close this week's show, as we always do, by welcoming astronomer and Planetary Society Director of Projects, Bruce Betts, to the stage for What's Up and the chance for our live audience to win a prize or two for themselves. Now, we knew that Emily Lakdawalla would be away on business this week. That's why she and I recently made the short drive from Planetary Society headquarters to the birthplace of a powerful new robot that will soon be exploring Mars. Here is the first of our two video reports. We're in Building 180 at the Jet Propulsion Laboratory. That's headquarters. So somewhere right over our head is Charles Alacci. He's the boss, the director of the laboratory. But much more significant for us, we are here with Emily and someone else that we're going to get to know a little bit better. Emily.
Hi, Matt.
What a great place to be.
It's spectacular to be here and so exciting to be waiting for this rover to land.
So you're going to take us through this in a couple of tours, and I think this time we're going to focus mostly on the cameras, and there are a lot of them, I guess, on Curiosity. And then we're going to do another segment, probably will air next week on the radio show, about the other instruments. So where do we start?
We'll start with the cameras, and there are 16 of them on this rover. Mm. We're going to start at the top and work our way down. So right at the very top, we have ChemCam, which is the laser on this robot's head. It can shoot a laser at a rock target, vaporize a little bit of it, and while it's doing that, it has a telescope that takes a very high-resolution photo of that spot that it's vaporized. And then it does that in order to get a chemical and mineral analysis.
And this is the ray gun that we Earthlings are sending to Mars.
That's right. We're sending it to Mars, not Mars sending it to us. It's a nice change. Okay, so moving down from ChemCam, we have the MastCams. These are these two different sized eyes on the rover. They're color cameras. One of them is zoomed in. One of them is a more wide angle. And those are designed to take color photos and actually HD video of the Martian landscape, although it's at a slightly lower frame rate than we do on Earth. It's 4 to 7 frames per second, depending on the exposure time. Moving outside from the MastCams, we have the NavCams. And those two pairs of NavCams are actually identical on this rover to the ones that were on Spirit and Opportunity. The only difference here is that there's two of them. There's two pairs on this rover. There was only one pair on Spirit and Opportunity because this rover is designed to last an awful lot longer than Spirit and Opportunity were. So we need to make sure that these cameras do not fail. There's a backup pair for redundancy. All right, so moving down from the mast, we go all the way down here.
Let's crouch right down here.
And we have the HazCams. Now, these cams are much like the NavCams up at the top of the mast. They are designed, they're very much the same as the ones that were on Spirit and Opportunity, and they look out in front of the rover to see the landscape, to get a good idea of the 3D landscape right in front of the rover and give some context for this gigantic robotic arm to be able to place its instruments very accurately on rock and soil targets. And speaking of that robotic arm, we go all the way down to the front. And this right here is the hand lens imager. It's like a geologist's hand lens. They use it to get very up close, very high resolution pictures of the rocks and soils right in front of the rover. This one, like the mast cams, is full color. And it's also got its own light sources, so it can illuminate the target very brightly. It's a really awesome camera.
So this is an analog to the hand lens that a geologist would carry.
Absolutely. These guys are built to be robotic geologists as much as possible because, it's after all, it's for the geology that we're sending these rovers to Mars. Now, there's one other very cool thing about this hand lens. Because it's on the end of an extremely long arm, it's actually taller than the rover, so it can hold this hand lens camera right over its head and actually use it almost like a periscope. It can take self-portraits, and it can see over rock walls, so it's a pretty amazing instrument.
It is entirely an amazing instrument. 16 cameras, you said?
16 cameras.
And we will be back next time to talk about the other instruments on Curiosity. And Emily, thank you so much. We'll see you then.
All right. Thank you, Matt.
Emily Lakdawalla is the Science and Technology Coordinator for the Planetary Society and a contributing editor to Sky and Telescope magazine. She joins us every week on Planetary Radio, but this time and next time from JPL. I want to thank Lauren Roberts of Harkin Creative in Pasadena for shooting and editing that video for us. Listeners, you can see it in the multimedia section of our website, planetary.org, or find it on the Planetary Society YouTube page. Emily asked me to tell you well-informed fans of Curiosity that she knows about the rover's 17th camera. It's the so-called descent imager. It will be active as the big robot plunges to the Martian surface on August 5th or 6th, depending on your time zone. We'll be celebrating that landing all of that weekend, August 4 and 5, in Pasadena with Planet Fest, but also with our live webcast, so people can participate anywhere around the world, and there's more about that at planetfest.org. I told you we hadn't heard the last of Michael Nieto. Here's his take on a traditional sea shanty, updated for the seas that await us in space. Ladies and gentlemen, Michael Nieto.
This is a Neptune. It's one of the few space shanties out there. I'm a biologist first and a space shanty writer second, so.
So hoist up the solar sail and trim the inertial vectors. We're off to ride the cosmic tide into uncharted sectors and charge up the ion drive and chart the navigation. We'll be mates in altered states in cryo-hibernation. Be sure to grab a lime when space-time gets all curvy. Throwing up in zero-G is worse when you have scurvy. While on the beach of Titan, the snorkeling's insane. But if you dip your toes, better hold your nose, cause the sea is liquid methane. So hoist up the solar sail and trim the inertial vectors. We're off to ride the cosmic tide into uncharted sectors and charge up the ion drive and chart the navigation. We'll be mates in altered states in cryo-hibernation. Comet hits the hull and our oxygen's escaping. Don't despair about the air, we'll fix it with duct taping. There's a Martian lass I long to see with a dusty red complexion. Men all stare, but I don't care, she's a holodeck projection. So hoist up the solar sail and trim the inertial vectors. We're off to ride the cosmic tide into uncharted sectors and charge up the ion drive and chart the navigation. We'll be mates in altered states in cryo-hibernation. So hoist up the solar sail and trim the inertial vectors. We're off to ride the cosmic tide into uncharted sectors and charge up the ion drive and chart the navigation. We'll be mates in altered states in cryo-hibernation.
Michael Nieto, he'll have one more tune for us, a little bit more instrumental music later in the show. Mike is a busy actor and musician whose day job is working as a restoration ecologist. He's a biologist, as you heard. He was raised here in Long Beach, which is also where he fell in love with our announcer, Laura Kaplan Nieto. Yes, full disclosure, they are my son-in-law and daughter. They work cheap. I'll be back with Dave Bader, Kevin Hand, and Bill Nye, the science guy, in a minute. This is Planetary Radio Live.
Bill Nye the Science Guy here. The next Mars rover, Curiosity, is about to land on Mars. You can join the celebration. Planet Fest 2012 is Saturday and Sunday, August 4th and 5th at the Pasadena Center in California. I'll be there with dozens of special guests, spacecraft displays, a space art show, great activities for kids, Planetary Radio Live, and the landing on Sunday night. Kids 8 and under are free. You can learn more at planetfest.org. It's a Planet Fest. I'll see you there.
Hi, this is Emily Lakdawalla of the Planetary Society. We've spent the last year creating an informative, exciting, and beautiful new website. Your Place in Space is now open for business. You'll find a whole new look with lots of images, great stories, my popular blog, and new blogs from my colleagues and expert guests. And as the world becomes more social, we are too, giving you the opportunity to join in through Facebook, Google+, Twitter, and much more. It's all at planetary.org. I hope you'll check it out.
Welcome back to Planetary Radio Live. I'm Matt Kaplan. We're in front of a capacity crowd at Southern California's Aquarium of the Pacific. And if you would, please welcome the chief executive officer of the Planetary Society, my boss, Bill Nye, the science guy.
Greetings, Earthlings.
Bill, I'm especially glad you could join in today's conversation because I know how passionate you are, not just about exploration, but the search for life and discovering our own origin.
Well, that's it. We're living at a time where ocean science is merging with planetary science. I mean, we all live on a planet. We are discovering oceans on other worlds. And the big thing, I guess we're going to talk about this, the big thing is in astrobiology is a solvent. If you're going to be a living thing, there must be some liquid that moves chemicals around. And the best one we can find so far is water. And so we're at the aquarium. Coincidence? So it's really an exciting time. And I just remind everybody that if this mission to Mars, if we find evidence of ancient life on Mars, it will change the world. It will change the world.
Thanks, Bill. Dave Bader is Director of Education here at the Aquarium, where he has worked for 14 years. He and his staff serve 1.5 million guests each year. That includes 200,000 school children who walk through these beautiful exhibits. The marine biologist is president of the Southwest Marine and Aquatic Educators Association. Please welcome Dave Bader.
Thank you.
And our other guests filling out our panel today, just last year, the National Geographic Society gave this astronomer and planetary scientist and astrobiologist its Emerging Explorer Award. He is the Jet Propulsion Lab's Deputy Chief Scientist for Solar System Exploration. And back in 1999, he founded Cosmos Education, an NGO that is devoted to science and technology education in the developing world. Please help me welcome Kevin Hand.
Thanks, Scott.
Kevin, I'm going to start with you. When I asked who I should talk to about Seas on Other Worlds, a lot of people told me I wanted Kevin Hand. How did this become such an important subject of study for you?
That's an interesting question. I grew up in the landlocked state of Vermont, so the connection to oceans is a little bit odd. But growing up in that small town under beautiful, clear skies, there is it's not hard for a young child to make the connection to the stars and to start thinking about whether or not there could be life beyond Earth. As much as I love the possibility of life on Mars and the past habitability of Mars, it's really these worlds like Europa, one of the moons of Jupiter, that we think has an ocean today. An ocean that's got 2 to 3 times the volume of all the liquid water on Earth. It's there today. It's been there for the history of the solar system. And if we've learned anything about life on Earth, it's that where you find the liquid water, you find life. So Europa is this place that I have just become fixated on. And hopefully, within the next couple of decades, we will send a spacecraft out there to explore Europa to see whether or not it is, in fact, habitable and potentially inhabited.
Would we have to land on Europa to be able to find this evidence of life? In other words, if that life is, tens of kilometers underneath that thick layer of ice, how do we detect it from the surface?
Yeah, that's a great question, and it's a question that I think it benefits from thinking about the case of how we detect life on Earth from space. Obviously, we all see these satellite images, and we do a lot of monitoring of the Earth's biosphere from space. But when you really look at the details, it turns out that much of what we do for remote sensing of the Earth from space involves monitoring the pigments, like chlorophyll, that are associated with photosynthesis. I like to say that photosynthesis is sort of the spectroscopist or remote sensing scientist's evolutionary gift in that there are very specific absorption features in spectroscopy that allow us to monitor the photosynthetic activity on Earth.
So you detect certain frequencies of light indicate that there are plants growing.
Yeah, and they give off gases, and we can detect those. But so the problem then is on a world like Europa, where it's covered in ice, an ice shell that's maybe a few to as many as 15 kilometers in thickness.
Lot of ice.
Yeah, there's a lot of ice. You're not going to... Photosynthesis is not a very viable pathway, a very viable niche. And so we need to figure out other ways to potentially detect signs of life from an orbiting spacecraft. I would love to send a lander there. Just this past year, the Jet Propulsion Laboratory and NASA looked into a very complex lander design, which could be launched in the 2030 timeframe. I should mention these missions, these projects are not for the faint of heart. Right now, the best option for getting to Europa would be a launch by the European Space Agency in 2022.
Be here before you know it.
It gets out to the Jovian system in about 2030. My parents love it. It's job security. But it's not the type of thing where you get rapid return.
Hey, Dave Bader, clearly space scientists, astrobiologists are able to learn a great deal more and theorize, I'm sure, in better ways about these oceans elsewhere based on our knowledge of our oceans here. I wonder, you think that might reverse itself at some point, and knowledge of the water out there might help us down here?
Yeah, I mean, it couldn't hurt. I think also just that idea, that sense of needing to explore. I think, you know, when we think about it, we have only really discovered or explored about 5% of our oceans. And 95% of our oceans are left to be discovered. We think about ocean discovery as really the ocean bottom. But we kind of forget about the fact that we're passing through this zone, this habitable zone of liquid space, where it's also teeming with life. And we haven't really even explored that middle space. We sort of focused on, you know, a two-dimensional layer. We like to think of things in terms of ourselves. You know, we live on ground, so let's go to the ground first and look around. But there's that space in the middle that we can explore. When I was drawn into marine biology, it wasn't because I loved dolphins or sharks or something like that. It was because I loved exploration. I saw a documentary, I think it was Jacques Cousteau, and he was at the Marianas Trench with an ROV. I didn't know at the time that people had actually gone down once to the Marianas, now since been back. But I wanted to be the first person to get down there. And it's that sense of exploration that I think is similar in space exploration and ocean exploration. But it's not just the deep sea that needs to be explored. I mean, we have just recently heard a researcher who did a transect of 60 feet of water off of the Aleutian Archipelago and discovered new species of algae, of invertebrate. You know, anytime we go out into the ocean to a space we haven't been before, we find new things. Every time we go to the bottom of the ocean, we're discovering new species. So there's a tremendous amount to be learned.
Kevin Hahn mentioned how methods of observing Earth from space have been extremely useful in exploring other worlds. That's something the aquarium pays some attention to as well, Earth observation.
Yeah, absolutely. We have an opportunity. We have we've won a brand new grant from NASA called Our Instrumented Earth. So next summer we're going to have a brand new exhibit that you can come and explore. When people think of NASA, they think of Earth out, looking out into space, but NASA does a fair amount of Earth in. Looking at our world and how we observe our planet and how we know the things that we know about our planet. And that exhibit's going to revolve all around those types of instrumentation and how we know about El Nino and weather and plant life on the planet, all of those things. And this will be an exhibit that explains all that in a really fabulous way. We have a Science on a Sphere in our Ocean Science Center that is amazing at showing these visualizations. So it should be a pretty fun exhibit.
Bill, Dave, Kevin, we're out of time for this week's portion of our conversation, but we'll continue it on air and online in next week's episode. Thank you very much for joining us. Dave Bader is Director of Education here at the Aquarium of the Pacific. Kevin Hahn is Deputy Chief Scientist for Solar System Exploration at JPL. And Bill, I look forward to your regular Planetary Radio segment next time. Thanks for coming down to Long Beach today.
Thank you, Matt.
Thank you.
It's changed the world, everyone.
And Bill Nye, the science and planetary guy. He's the Planetary Society CEO. Dr. Bruce Betts is an astronomer and the Planetary Society's Director of Projects. Each week he joins us for a segment we cleverly call What's Up? Welcome, Bruce.
Thank you.
All right, so
it's pretty cool digs you got us here.
Isn't this nice? This is the Ocean's Theater at the aquarium. Oh, you know what?
Yeah, well, Matt's just going to walk over there and grab a piece of clothing.
I forgot to put on my bald aquarium vest.
Ah.
Hey.
Hey, give us a spin. Give us
a little... No. All right, please, what's up?
All right, in the evening sky, in the early evening, you can look over in the west and check out Mars and Venus. Mars looking reddish and Venus over to its left. Venus is near the star Spica, which is bluish, and Saturn is yellowish. All of these ishes are technical terms.
It's funny, you don't look bluish. It's an old yellow submarine joke. Go ahead.
If you pick up this podcast right away, or for the live listeners, on July 24th, the moon will be right in between Spica and Saturn on one side and Mars on the other. And we'll be hanging out nearby over on the 25th as well. In the pre-dawn sky, two super bright objects. You've got Jupiter and the even brighter Venus below it, low on the horizon in the east in the pre-dawn. We move on to this week in space history. It was 40 years ago, Matt, that Landsat 1 was launched, and NASA's pretty justifiably proud of 40 continuous years of Earth observations from space from the impressive Landsat program.
As we were talking about just moments ago on the show.
1971, Apollo 15 launched, headed to the moon, and of course carried the first lunar rover. Coolness. All right.
Hey, we should do a little crowdsourcing for this next thing. Right?
Yes, we should.
Yeah,
okay.
Absolutely.
So I want to get everyone to help me. All of you listeners know, next I do some goofy form of the words random space fact. So if you want to just yell random space fact, and I'll count to three, and you'll go, random space fact. One, two, three.
Random space fact.
Wow. Nailed it.
Wow.
Nice.
Wow. Very impressive. So in our special oceans episode, I thought I'd share with you the surface area of the Earth's oceans, so all the Earth's oceans combined, is about 2.5 times larger than the entire surface area of Mars.
Wow, that's impressive.
They're big.
That's both random and impressive.
That's the goal. All right, we move on to the trivia contest.
Great.
We asked you, where can you find Bill in the solar system? So where... in the solar system, and there was no Nye, but there's a Nile crater. Where in the solar system is Nile crater? How'd we do, Matt?
Lots and lots of people found this, and it turns out there is a relatively small crater. Maybe you can petition for something a little larger, Bill. It's about around 11 kilometers on Venus. Did people find the right one, Nile?
Yes, that's it.
Apparently all these surface features on Venus are named after women?
Almost all of them. We've had in a previous contest, there is one exception named after a man and a couple not named after women. But this is a woman's name in, what is the language?
Mandingo?
Mandingo.
Yeah.
West African language.
Very cool. Our winner this week, Kurt Lewis. Now, this is a great coincidence. Kurt Lewis of Missouri City, Texas, who's going to get that engraved planetary, Radio Planetary Society Fisher space pen. Can I have it?
Ooh.
They're good. He was just complaining to me that he's entered the contest repeatedly. He gets quoted because he says funny stuff that we quote all the time. He'd never won the contest. And random.org chose him. It's so cool.
That is impressive destiny. So the trivia contest, for those listeners at home or those of you here, we talked about Enceladus, another one of those, it's another one of those places with those crazy water ice geysers. Okay, it's the place with the crazy water ice geysers around Saturn. What are all features on Enceladus named after? Where does the naming convention for Enceladus come from? Go to planetary.org/radio, find out how to enter.
And you have until July 30, Monday, July 30 at 2 p.m. Pacific time to enter this iteration of the Space Trivia Contest and maybe win yourself a Fisher space pen. We've got to get rid of some prizes. So, are you ready to do our little live and in-person Space Trivia Contest?
I am. I'm ready. Is the audience ready?
Yeah.
Yeah. All right. Question number one.
Question number one, and you heard reference to this in the planetary sea shanty. What are Titan's seas or lakes thought to be made of primarily?
The seas are made of methane.
Yes, primarily methane.
All right.
Methane, ethane.
Throw that man a huggable Mars. Here it goes, right. A stuffed
Beware.
Mars. Good shot. All right.
It was exciting. All right. We talked about Europa and tides. This one a little tricky. The largest three Galileo satellites, I'm sorry, the three inner Galileo satellites, big moons of Jupiter, are in an orbital resonance. What is the ratio of the orbital periods of Ganymede to Europa to Io?
Ooh, tough one. That's a hard one.
Expert guests in the audience.
Kevin Han? No.
Prohibited from entering.
No, you're disqualified anyway. Anybody want to take a shot at this? The ratio over here. Someone's got a guess. Or maybe he knows.
So if you take the length of the period of each of those.
I'm not sure. I sort of like, I think I read it somewhere. 4, 2, 1.
Perfect.
Oh, yes.
Very impressive.
And good catch. All right.
All right. And so back to Enceladus. In what diffuse ring of Saturn does Enceladus exist? And it also provides particles into that ring. It's a letter.
All those rings are lettered, you know. You watch Emily Lakdawalla's Snapshot from Space, and she'll tell you how to identify the rings right here. Hi.
E-ring?
Very impressive. E-ring is correct.
Wow. Great job. Yeah.
This is like the smartest group ever.
All right, everybody, go out there, look up the night sky, and think about fish and how amazing and wonderful they are in all their shapes and sizes. Thank you, and good night.
And you can see them all in all those shapes and sizes and colors and variations right here at the Aquarium of the Pacific, which has been our host today. He's Bruce Betts, though, the Planetary Society's Director of Projects, joins me each week for What's Up. Please welcome back Mike Nieto to close out our show. Clear skies and seas, everyone.
Is produced by the Planetary Society in Pasadena, California, and made possible by a grant from the Kenneth T. and Eileen L. Norris Foundation, and by members of the Planetary Society. We thank the Aquarium of the Pacific for its support. Our recording engineer is Keith Miller and Brian Daly. Ron Pet.